And I do need to let all of you know, I have no financial relationships to disclose related to this program, and please remind our speakers to also make that quick disclosure at the beginning. Thank you.
Okay, welcome. It's a packed house. Well, Mary and I are very, very pleased to be part of this very important session today. And for the next 15 minutes, we'd like to invite you to travel with us to California through four community-based participatory research projects to examine how CBPR, when done right, can truly be a best practice for increasing the success of interventions and effectively translating research into sustainable health-promoting programs, practices, and policies. We just look like that. Can we forward it?
Is that not working?
Okay. We have nothing to disclose, and that's what it says on here. It is. Oh, it's just a little slow. Okay. Well, going the wrong way. Okay. So, Carol Horowitz expressed our sentiments exactly, and perhaps many of yours as well, when she wrote in a recent article in the journal Circulation that CBPR may be the ultimate form of translational research, moving discoveries bidirectionally from bench to bedside to el barrio, or the community, to organizations and to policymakers. As most of us in this room would acknowledge, we have a lot of room for improvement in the area of research translation. Our record in both medicine and public health is, pardon me, but dismal indeed. The most successful interventions rarely reach more than 1% of the target population, and the time lag for turning just a fraction of research into clinical application is almost 2 decades. While all of Barbara Israel's core principles of CBPR are very important for this process, we'd like to highlight three that are especially critical for research translation. These are that CBPR disseminates results to all partners and involves them in wider dissemination, that CBPR balances research and action and involves long-term process and is very truly and sincerely committed to sustainability. One critical benefit of CBPR is its potential for enhancing the cultural relevance and uptake of interventions, and I'd like to share with you two CBPR interventions to illustrate our point. Although the limited time today precludes my going into much detail, I want to mention that both of these projects started with topics of priority for the community, that the interventions, research trial, and subsequent dissemination and translational activities were developed and conducted with high levels of participation from both community-based organizations and community members themselves. The first CBPR example that I'd like to share is from my own work. Reducing pesticide exposures to farmworkers' children is a partnership between UC Berkeley, community partners, and farmworkers themselves in one of the largest agricultural areas of California, the Salinas Valley. For over 2 decades, our center has been conducting the first longitudinal study of pesticide exposures in children's health in the United States. In parallel with the epidemiologic research, however, we've been working on prevention. Numerous studies now demonstrate the disproportionately high levels of agricultural pesticide exposure to farmworkers' children, and recent work is showing us clearly that there are impacts on neurodevelopment and growth. Unlike other industries, agriculture provides few provisions to reduce farmworkers' pesticide exposures and no provisions to reduce take-home exposures to farmworkers' children. Along with our community advisory board and a council of 10 farmworkers, we developed the first worksite intervention to address this issue, which we then tested in a randomized controlled trial with strawberry workers, 130 of them, at 2 strawberry farms. Farmworker involvement in this study was critical in coming up with protective clothing that would be acceptable for workers in the field. The coveralls and gloves developed in our intervention were selected by the Farmworker Council and then tested in a worksite pilot. By way of their input, we learned that we would need to provide shirts for female workers to cover them modestly as they bent down to pick the berries. And we would also need to develop our own coverall, as none of the coveralls available on the market were comfortable enough for farm work. From the community, we also learned that the belief that washing warm hands in cold water causes arthritis was a persistent barrier to hand washing among farm workers. Assisted by our community advisory board, one of our members who worked in agriculture, we developed a system for providing warm water in the fields. Our farmworker council also informed us of many other cultural issues and motivations for behavior change that we incorporated into our field-based educational curriculum that was administered in the fields by former farm workers. While we did not succeed in changing all targeted behaviors, we had great success in a very difficult intervention environment. We had significant increases in glove use. We had over 90% compliance with coverall use and significant changes in work clothing and also hand washing during breaks. The second example of a study that I'd like to share with you is conducted by colleagues from Stanford, which was looking at whether it was possible to adapt the Stanford University Chronic Disease Self-Management Program for Native Americans. And as we all know well, this population is extremely burdened by diabetes and urgently needs better interventions for both management and prevention. Our colleague Valerie Jernigan worked closely with the Community Advisory Panel of Native Americans with Diabetes in Santa Clara County and determined that Stanford's program could be relevant for Native Americans but would need to be adapted. They adapted the curriculum closely together, and some of the adaptations that they did were to have Native peer educators, blessing and sudging ceremonies at the beginning of each session, to begin class sessions late, and to lengthen the class sessions to allow for storytelling. They also adapted the symptom cycle from the original curriculum into a dream catcher designed by one of the community advisory board members. Based on the success of the pilot in Santa Clara County, the tailored curriculum was then adapted for the internet and piloted with 29 Native Americans from 18 tribes. This internet program was using all of the adaptations from the Santa Clara study, as well as quotes and photos from the work in Santa Clara, and showed they had 100% retention rate and many improvements in a variety of disease symptoms and self-management behaviors. And as you can see from this quote, the Native participants really did appreciate the internet program. Based on this success, the internet program was then widely disseminated and tested again in a randomized controlled trial conducted with 110 Native participants from over 70 tribes. And 6-month outcomes showed significant decreases in health distress and activity limitations, and also A1C levels in the intergroup decreased, however not significantly, but this is likely due to the modest sample size. So now I'd like to turn it over to Mary, who's going to...
You're going to stay there and help me with the tech. We have a little age difference here, and I need help. Okay, we are going to turn now to how CBPR adds value in real time to the dissemination and translation of research findings. And our first example comes from an ecological CBPR study that we've both been privileged to work on with restaurant workers in San Francisco's Chinatown. Our partners include two universities, Berkeley with its Labor Occupational Health Program, UCSF, and also the Chinese Progressive Association, the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and restaurant workers themselves. 6 restaurant workers were hired and extensively trained as a core group of worker leaders, and another 21 as surveyors. Our community partners made huge contributions to study design, data collection, including collecting 433 detailed surveys, and interpretation of findings from both individual and restaurant level data collection. But we're focusing here on their very important roles in the later stages of the work. To ensure the dissemination and use of findings beyond professional and academic channels, we helped our community partners secure a $400,000 grant from the California Endowment to help support the substantial translation, education, and action pieces of the project that our federal grant just didn't cover. The dissemination phase of the project, including sharing findings with the ethnic media, with restaurant workers through the holding of bi-monthly educational teas, and with regulatory agencies through outreach from the health department partner to OSHA and other bodies, sharing with them the findings on which they had enforcement responsibility. But central to our dissemination campaign was the development of a community-authored report in 3 languages that presented key findings and emphasized those of greatest concern to workers, key among them wage theft. The fact that 53% of these workers experienced having slow pay or no pay of back wages, getting often far below minimum wage, not getting overtime, etc. The report contextualized the findings
And it also included as a centerpiece our action plan, a low-wage worker bill of rights. The report launch was attended by 170 people, including over 20 from the mainstream and ethnic press, and four of the 11 city supervisors. Most all of the speakers were our Chinatown partners, and their messages were heard. We got coverage in the nightly news, the ethnic press, on YouTube, and in a major article on wage theft in the front of the business section in the San Francisco Chronicle. We're not quite there yet.
Sorry.
To broaden the base of support for its work, the CPA played a lead role in building alliances across low-wage groups. So they formed the Progressive Workers Alliance, and that group, plus the CPA, went to work with two supervisors drafting a wage theft ordinance. Rallies and additional press events followed at City Hall and elsewhere, and these events, too, got great coverage, including this front-page article in the Chronicle. Well, this past August, the supervisors unanimously passed the wage theft ordinance, and the mayor signed the bill the next month, making San Francisco the first city in the country to enact such legislation. Now, of course, we will be keeping close tabs on implementation, particularly in these dismal economic times. But meanwhile, let me turn very quickly to our last case study, which took place in West Oakland, a vibrant community of 25,000 African American and Latino residents whose childhood asthma rates are seven times the state average, due in part to the high volume of diesel truck traffic to and through their community. The West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project is a nonprofit that grew out of an earlier CBPR project and that continues to partner with the Pacific Institute. Their early research, which included truck counts, truck idling studies, and air sampling, showed that with 633 truck trips per day, residents are exposed to diesel particulate matter at the rate of 90 times the state average. These findings were released in a highly publicized report, and the community and academic partners then called a series of meetings with the community where strategic planning took place and a policy goal identified, getting a truck ordinance that would stop trucks from using the city streets as a shortcut to the port. By continually asking who's not in the room, the partnership identified such unlikely bedfellows as the local port, independent truckers, and they met monthly to hammer out a route that they all could live with. That route was very close to the one adopted by the city and that now is in play. Now, as in Chinatown, getting adequate enforcement has been another matter in this time of reduced staffing, but a community partner now serves on the Port Authority, the Port Commission, and the partnership has continued its work, in particular helping to get a $22 million program passed that enables truckers to afford retrofits that we believe will cut emissions around the port by 85%. The partnership's also working with regulatory and statewide coalitions and helping other communities use their methodology. Well, I've given you quickly two examples of the dissemination and use of findings in real time to help bring about change. But as you know, this presents a real problem from an academic perspective. In Richard Hofreiter's words, what do we want? Evidence-based practice and policy. When do we want it? After peer review. Publishing, obviously, is critical to getting the word out. But to paraphrase Dennis Raphael, if an article is published in AJPH, but nobody reads it, does it exist? Well, it certainly exists in our world. It is terribly important that we build the evidence base. But truly, which article do you think will have the most impact? This one that is coming out, I think, in the next issue of AJPH, or this one-page article on the work of the partnership and its lead partner, Margaret Gordon, which came out in the October issue of Oprah? So in conclusion, we do think Carol Horowitz had it right, and that while CBPR is not appropriate for all or even most public health research, when it is appropriate, it may indeed be the ultimate form of translational research. But that's only, as Alicia said, if it's done well, with a commitment from the very beginning to action as part of the research process, tailoring interventions so they do increase uptake, multi-pronged dissemination, and ideally working upstream on policy-level interventions that have the greatest potential for improving the public's health. Thank you.